Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of the long and winding Royal Road. My name is W.H. Park. I am the co-host of the monthly Post Perez podcast with John Pollock. And of course, I did previous shows called Thunderstruck and The Cruel Summer, looking at the career of Jushin Thunder Liger and G1 Climax. But the long and winding Royal Road is not about New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's about All Japan Pro Wrestling, specifically about the 1990s era of All Japan Pro Wrestling, the era of the Four Pillars of Heaven, my favorite period of professional wrestling of all time. And we're gonna talk about two of the most important figures of that era. And joining me today is my guest, Brian Elliott. Brian was the editor of the now-defunct Fighting Spirit magazine. He does podcasting himself, as well as writing blogs about professional wrestling and other things as well, music and football. I took a look at his blog. He'll plug it during the course of this show. But Brian, how are you today?
I'm really good. How are you doing yourself?
I'm good. It's cold here in Toronto. It's November. There's snow on the ground. It's still dark. We're recording this like my morning, and I don't know. I'm dreading like my first full summer back in Toronto, because I've been living in Japan for the last 9 years and came back just recently. So it's something I'm bracing myself for, actually.
Yeah. So are you lucky to have a relatively cold summer then? Less humid, I would imagine.
The summer will be fine for me. You know, like I'm one thing I'm not going to miss, honestly, is the humidity of Japan, especially in the month of August. Mm-hmm. It's just unbelievably brutal. I always feel it's like easier to keep warm than it is to try to, yeah, you know, become cool during the summer, because you can always put more clothes on. There's only so many clothes you can take off.
Sure.
How's the weather? You're in Ireland, correct?
Yeah, Northern Ireland. So another one of the Irish connection, like Alan Forel and guys like this who seem to have permeated the wrestling scene. So we get about 2 weeks in about May time where it's really nice and summery, something that you'd really call a summer. But yeah, it lasts for 2 weeks and then it goes back to being dry at best and then gets cold again. So we're starting to get into the cool period now.
Okay, well, you know, at some point I'm gonna have to come visit your neck of the woods. I have like you know, our friend Alan Farrell, Jamesy, and JP.
Oh, yeah.
Well, JP's in England, but you know, like he considers himself Irish. I don't know, like, what actual Irish people think about JP, but it seems like they accept him as one of their own as well.
He's a decent enough guy. He's allowed to join.
He's a lot of joy. That's good. So, Brian, let's talk about you. Give the listeners a bit of a background about yourself, maybe about the start of your fandom for wrestling in general, how you started becoming like a podcaster and writer, as well as an editor for professional wrestling, as well as like maybe your specific fandom for All Japan of this era.
Wow, where to start? Okay, well, in terms of actually being a fan, that's really simple. The first American wrestling boom period in the UK was in around 1990-91. So it was the same kind of fandom that people would live, or kids would later have, for like Teenage Turtles or Pokemon or things like that. It was just the fad. Everyone in school was into it when I was 10 years old. So videotapes, WWF tapes got passed around. People were talking about the WCW that we'd have on TV at strange hours of the day and night. And but after sort of SummerSlam 92, of course, people think of as the peak, and it really was. But things went down after SummerSlam 92 in terms of fandom very, very fast. By Survivor Series 1992, there was nobody talking about this in the classroom. I kind of stayed on with pro wrestling and just built up my fandom, I guess, just kept finding more wrestling that I loved. That certainly was the case with All Japan Pro Wrestling. One of the predecessors to Fighting Spirit magazine, you may well know, was Power Slam magazine, edited by Finlay Martin, that ran in it sort of started in like the early 90s. I think 1992 was their first issue. And it did a lot of stuff for Japanese wrestling. If you were really into the scene in pro wrestling and learning a little bit about pro wrestling, that was the magazine to buy on the shelves in the early 90s. And they had a deal with I think it was Weekly Pro Wrestling. So you would occasionally get photographs from Weekly Pro in Power Slam magazine. So you would occasionally see Misawa or Kawada or Taue or any of these guys. And there'd be news from the title changes or a big match. And the text would talk about how great these matches were in very much an observer kind of style. And anybody who was reading that had to be thinking, I've got to see these matches. And conveniently, at the end of the magazine in the letters page, there was details of tape traders who had these matches. So I was just another one of those people who was a big wrestling fan, kept it going. And in the early 90s, when I was barely a teenager, we're starting to get tapes from traders who had got stuff from Japan. So I was seeing my first Misawa and Kawada matches by the time I was 13.
That's incredible. I wasn't really getting into the scene of All Japan Pro Wrestling until when I started university. So I'm in my early 20s and stuff like that. So at the age of 13 I'm quite envious of you there, Brian. But to your point about Power Slam magazine, when I started reading that, we were able to get Power Slam in Toronto at various news agents and things. I was really happy discovering this magazine and reading about the Japanese coverage, both with New Japan and All Japan at the time, because I thought one thing that I thought Finn Martin did really well was write about it. And the other writer at Power Slam was write about it in such a way that it was inclusive to new readers, people mm-hmm. who weren't familiar with the scene. If you were already familiar with the names, great. You could just jump right into these articles or these news bits. But if you weren't super familiar with it, the way these articles were written about, All Japan Pro Wrestling and New Japan Pro Wrestling was that, I can learn about this mm-hmm. as well. It's very easily. It's kind of the opposite, I feel, of the Wrestling Observer, where it's there's kind of this idea that you already know a lot about this stuff, that the stuff that Dave Meltzer writes about, which, I can get into the Observer when I started, subscribing to it myself. But I always felt like Power Slam was just a little bit more easier to get into for the layman or the neophyte to Japanese professional wrestling.
Yeah, and of course it had to be that way. They did a really good job of sort of distilling all of the news and what you could expect to see in those articles. If I turn around and say that it was quite simple writing, it sounds like I'm having a dig at the quality of writing, but I'm not. As you said, that brought a lot of people in, including myself, to try and understand the differences between American wrestling and Japanese wrestling, or even British wrestling. And that was my gateway to it. I don't know when I would have found Japanese wrestling had it not been for Power Slam magazine. Probably around sort of the early internet time, which for me would have been 97, 98.
Would you say you gravitated more towards All Japan versus New Japan?
All Japan. I did love both, but very clearly All Japan. To me, the differences in King's Road and Strong Style, King's Road has far more of an ebb and flow. I like the pacing a lot better. In New Japan matches, one of the things that people often like about New Japan matches is that sometimes the tide can turn quite abruptly, with one strike, or there's almost sort of a martial arts element to some of, especially the earlier matches from the 80s and maybe the early 90s. But to me, All Japan always had a really good ebb and flow. Pacing was always perfect. And I guess that's what appealed to me more than anything.
I think on this kind of tangent about the difference between Strong Style and King's Road or Royal Road style is that, if you look at the origins, Strong Style is, steeped in the philosophy of Antonio Inoki, the founder of New Japan Pro Wrestling. And he's very, very much into the whole idea of martial arts of mm-hmm. Being using a lot of submissions and think this high idea that, the tide can turn suddenly.
Yes.
Whereas the basis of King's Road is really American pro wrestling, because mm-hmm. Not only was Giant Baba the creator of it, but he started All Japan with the help of, for example, Terry and Dory Funk Jr. And they are obviously, very, very much American pro wrestlers. And I think that's something that Baba always thought was really good about American professional wrestling, was it's this struggle between two competitors, and that there's an ebb and flow. There's American wrestling is very steeped in storytelling.
Yeah, and there's a beauty to the sort of mixed martial, or sorry, the martial arts side of it, where you can kind of get a quick knockout or a strike. One kick from Hashimoto, for example, can mean so much. What you're doing on King's Road in the King's Road style is taking people on an emotional journey, ups and downs, peaks and valleys, and leading to the conclusion. It's kind of hard to describe. Maybe if you were watching along, you could describe it a little bit better as people saw what was going on. But that's what it is to me. It's the emotional roller coaster of the matches that go sort of up and down. You can kind of see them form as they go along.
And how about you? Before we get into the match, let's talk about your career as an editor. How did you get involved with becoming an editor for Fighting Spirit magazine and just making all these connections and as well as a podcaster in your own right?
I am a newspaper person by trade. So I started in the Belfast Telegraph newspaper, which is Northern Ireland's national newspaper pretty much. I was in there for several years just working in the sports desk. And so it was a good grinding for me. That was my education there. I learned everything in there. I'm not actually a trained journalist. I don't have a journalism qualification per se. Everything was done on the ground in the actual building, putting the newspaper out on deadlines. So I guess you could say I learned the hard way, but definitely the good way as well. So I did that for around 5 years or so. And then I got the opportunity to become the editor of Fighting Spirit magazine. I had written some columns and done some interviews and things for them. And the outgoing editor, Martin Mathers, I had a conversation with him about taking up the role, and he certainly had my back when it came to that. And it was a pretty simple process then for me to take over the editing of that magazine. It was very much like doing a newspaper, except instead of having two deadlines every day, you only had one every month. So that was really nice too.
So I'm sure that's a lot easier to manage. And in Fighting Spirit magazine, obviously you're covering American wrestling, because that's what's going to sell copies on the newsstand. But also you did cover a lot of Japanese wrestling in there.
Yeah, definitely. My goal with Fighting Spirit was always to increase everybody's fandom, let people know where good wrestling exists. And let them know more about the wrestling that they already enjoy to gain a greater understanding of it. So we had, great columns from guys like Jim Cornette. For a while, we had Steve Austin doing a column, which was quite remarkable in hindsight. But we also had great writers who were able to explain all of the stuff that was going on in the world of wrestling, look back to the past to show how things were done back then, tell the great stories of the time. So, I felt very privileged. So I worked on that between 2010 and 2019. And, it's been a year since we finished up with Fighting Spirit magazine. And, it takes a toll on you doing, being the editor and working long hours and just watching tons of stuff constantly and thinking about wrestling 24/7. But, a year or so after I finished, I kind of feel like, I wish it was still there.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think there's.
But it did take me a year to recover.
Well, that's good. As long as you're recovering. I do think there's a void in losing a publication like Fighting Spirit magazine, and who knows, maybe in the future something will take its place. Maybe you'll be involved with that. But let's
I got a couple of different ideas. Maybe we'll talk about them at the end.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Let's talk about today's match, Brian. Let's talk about the match you picked, and what is that match?
That match is Toshiaki Kawada against Akira Taue. That is the Champion Carnival match from April 12th, 1993.
That is correct. And a bit of a background on this. I'm going to let you extrapolate more on the background. But a quick background is that, before this match, for the last 2 years, Kawada and Taue had been kind of feuding with each other because they were on opposite ends of a war between two different groups. One is the Super Generation Army, consisting of Kawada, Mitsuhara Misawa, Kenta Kobashi, and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi. On the other hand, we have Akira Taue, who's the second member, the second man in the unit called Tsurutagun, which is led, of course, by Jumbo Tsuruta. And it also had Taue, it also had Masafuchi, and it later would include Yoshinari Ogawa, young Yoshinari Ogawa, which if you see him now, he's still wrestling in 2020. But if you see Ogawa now and Ogawa then, it's, you can see he hasn't aged that badly, to be honest with you. He looks pretty good. He's still an amazing wrestler, to be honest as well. But, you know, like these two, whenever they would have these multi-man tag matches with like Super Generation Army, Saruta Gun, a lot of the times when Kawada and Tawei would get in the ring, they would just like raise the intensity of these tag matches where they're just like beating the shit out of each other. They would fight on the outside. Sometimes weapons would get involved. Sometimes people would, you know, Tawei or Kawada would start bleeding. Usually it'd be Tawei.
Yeah.
And they would have a lot of like, you know, they would get involved in singles matches and with each other as well. And these were very, very intense. But at the time of this match, like Jumbo has pretty much wrapped up due to illness. And like, so like, you know, the idea is that, you know, like we need a new rival for Misawa, and this match kind of lays the groundwork for the creation of that new rival for Misawa, because Kawada at this point is still a member of Super Generation Army. He's seconded by Kikuchi on the outside during this match, but soon things will change after the course of this match. But what else can you tell us about kind of the background between Kawada and Tawei here, Brian?
You did a pretty good job there. At one point, though, Tawei was a babyface himself. I don't know if he possibly was not an official member of Super Generation Army. Perhaps you know.
Well, he was affiliated. He was
around,
with
yes,
it.
He was around them for sure. But
because, like you know, the when Misawa wins that you know that match, that pivotal match against Jumbo Tsuruta, it's him being hoisted on the shoulders of Kawada and Kobashi, but there's Tawei in the background. Yep. But soon after that, you know, Tawei jumps ship. I think right. That's where a lot of the you know, quote unquote hatred of like the Super Generation towards Tawei exists, because they felt he betrayed them to join Jumbo. But like in previous episodes of this series, like I talked about, like, well, why wouldn't you? If you're Tawei, you're the number four guy. It's obviously going to be Misawa's number one, Kawada's number two, Kobashi is number three, and Tawei's number four. And unfortunately, that leaves Kikuchi as number five. But, you know, if you get a chance, like, you know, like in kayfabe terms, obviously, you get a chance to see, like Jumbo says, hey, I want you to be my regular tag partner. Holy shit. I'm going to be, instead of the number four guy in this group of my, you know, generational peers, I'm going to be the number two guy, the regular tag team partner of the ace of this company, Jumbo Tsuruta, the legendary Jumbo Tsuruta, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. If I'm Tawei, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm going to take that, because I'm going to be the number two instead of the number four guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's logical.
And there's physical comparisons between Jumbo and Tawei as well, just their sort of size. And you could see, if again, in sort of kayfabe terms, if you will, you could see how Saruta might tell Tawei that he is, you know, going to mentor him, how he could have a similar career. You know, I'm sort of extrapolating that when it may not be the case, but you can see that. So yeah, that switch of Tawei to Saruta Gun occurred in 1990. This match that we're going to talk about, Kawada and Tawei, 3 years later in 1993, but you know, not a dissimilar thing happens when Kawada jumps ship to the other side. They, as you said, they had had they had lit up these sort of six man matches and occasional tag team matches throughout that period. There's one particularly great singles match that I can recall in January 91. It's a bloody brawl that's won by Kawada. But it does take a couple of years for it to get round to this. But eventually Kawada does sort of jump to the other side, and history has kind of changed for All Japan from this point in, because it results in the formation of the Holy Demon Army, Kawada and Tawei as a tag team. And that just sets up so many great matches throughout the rest of the decade.
Well, I mean, we'll talk more about the Holy Demon Army as close off the podcast after we talk about the match itself. But one thing I want to make a point of, like you kind of extrapolate, you kind of like touched upon this, was that like, you know, Tawei was the kind of like the disciple of Jumbo Tsuruta, which is funny because like it seems like, you know, Kawada's two greatest rivalries in the history of his the 90s All Japan era was against Misawa, who is also, you know, kind of like, you know, mentored by Jumbo Tsuruta. And then with Tawei during the 90 to 92 period, who, you know, because like the interesting thing about Kawada is that he was mentored by Jinichiro Tenryu, who was the rival, of course, of Jumbo Tsuruta before he left All Japan to join SWS and form WAR later on. What's interesting is that like Kawada's like this guy who just keeps having these kind of intense rivalries with, you know, the kind of the guys who were mentored by Jumbo Tsuruta.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, there's that the famous tag team match from, is it Tag League 88? And it's Kawada teaming with Tenryu. Is that against Yatsu and Jumbo?
Yeah, I think so, yes, yeah.
Yeah, so that's like a really famous, like, five-star classic match, a really great storyline throughout the match. So, yeah, I guess in the sort of, in stylistic terms, Kawada is closer to Tenryu than he is to Jumbo, so you can see it in that regard. There's all different kinds of sort of personalities going on across all these Super Generation Army and Tsurugun and wrestling styles too. It just all comes together in one wonderful package.
Well, I mean, you mean like visually, Kawada is, you know, adopting the colors of
sure.
Tenryu, the black and the yellow, whereas like no one really adopts the colors of Jumbo, which is just plain old, you know, black trunks and black boots and black knee pads and the black elbow pad. You know, like the thing about like also Tawe is like you say there's physical similarities between him and Jumbo. I actually think there's a lot of physical similarities between him and Giant Baba. And, yeah. You know, in my headcanon, I always thought, oh, the reason this guy gets pushed, because when I started watching All Japan, I was not really a fan of Akira Tawe. I've grown to appreciate him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's an amazing worker. But I was like, this guy must be getting a push because Baba sees himself
yeah.
Tawe, because he's kind of gangly looking. He's
right.
Tall. He's kind of awkward.
Kind of hunched over.
Yeah. So this is why. It's like, oh, he looks at Tawe as like, you know, his successor physically and like the way he wrestles. And so but obviously it's because Tawe was actually a really great wrestler mm-hmm. in his own right. Not in the classic sense of like, you know, you can see why Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada are pushed because they're great wrestlers in a more traditional sense. Whereas Tawe's great in more kind of like an awkward sense. And
yeah.
I'll probably use that word a lot when yeah. talking about Tawe's offense here.
It's really easy to write Tawe off like that whenever you first see him. He's so awkward looking. He's got a very strange gait. He looks nothing like an athlete, quite frankly. But then you look at the matches. If you investigate them, he's been involved in some of the greatest matches in all Japan history. One match that rarely is talked about, but is one of my personal favorites, is I think it's April 95 against Misawa. Might even be a carnival final. And that is just a classic match, a five-star match if ever there was one.
Oh, yeah. If you really explore Akira Tawe's career, like multiple tag matches, his tag team with Jumbo Tsuruta, his tag team with Kawada, and then, you know, tons of singles matches against tons of people, Misawa, Kawada, Kobashi, you know, Stan Hansen, Steve Williams, all of them, all the, you know, the familiar names you would associate with All Japan of this era. But let's get to this match, Kawada versus Tawe, April 12th, 1993, from the Champions Carnival. Now, there are two versions of this that we found on YouTube. One is a clipped official version of this match, but I also came across a full version of this match that's a handheld version of this match that was shot by a fan. It's not a bad version. I would recommend people watch both.
Oh yeah.
I watched the handheld version first, and then I, you know, kind of filled in like, you know, the rest of the match with like the clip version, which comes in about, I'd say, like, you know, 15-20 minutes in the remaining 15-20 minutes of the match.
Mm-hmm.
And what's good about watching both is that, you know, like you can hear kind of like the mic'd ring. You can hear the sounds of like the strikings a little bit better. That's not to say like, you know, Kawada chops Tawe throughout the course of this match really hard. Like even the handheld version, like it's really fucking loud, Brian.
Yeah, and Tawe, when you look at his face on his chest after taking those, he's just incredulous that somebody could even dare to hit him so hard. He can't believe he's been hit so hard. So yeah, it's a really great visual. The cool thing about the handheld as well is I believe it's shot from the opposite side to the hard cam, so you get like a slightly different perspective of things that are going on. And also, if you look on the handheld, you'll see in one of the front rows of the crowd is Baba himself doing commentary, so you get to see his expressions as the match goes on.
Well, I'm always worried, like, at some point, you know, Giant Baba is going to notice his band with, like, you know, a 1990s camcorder illegally recording the show. Maybe he's going to call the security to kick this fan out. But thankfully that does not happen. And we are reaping the benefits of this, nefarious fan illegally recording this and uploading it to YouTube. But
I think on the same night, it's, Kobashi against Misawa. And that also survives from that handheld tape. So thank goodness that that person was recording and that Baba couldn't get to him in time.
That's good. I don't know. Like, at some point, maybe Baba sees this is showing up on all the tape traders list, and he's like, I gotta, you know, step up security for camcorders and things like that. Now, like, nowadays, Brian, you can just, like, wear, you know, specialized glasses and record everything through Google Lens or something like that. I don't know. But let's talk about the match. Tawei comes out first and he gets cheers from fans. And then Kawada is out next. And I felt he gets noticeably louder cheers from the fans. Like, people are calling his name. Obviously, the more popular wrestler in this contest is Kawada.
Yeah, I think that's quite correct. And of course, that would be natural. You know, he is in the babyface super generation army, and there's no question as to that being the case. There's no question, in fact, of anything sort of strange happening. There doesn't appear to be any, just from watching the video, maybe the commentary says something different, but there doesn't appear to be any sort of subtext to Kawada, you know, thinking about becoming a heel or anything as simple as that. You know, what you're thinking of as these two guys are coming to the ring is they're going to have another singles match. This is a feud that's been going on for a long time. Someone wants to progress in the champion carnival, and you just wonder who it's going to be.
Right. And as the match starts, I felt it was like a pretty sedate beginning, considering, you know, like the history between these two that we talked about. They're kind of just feeling each other out. Kawada does start to amp up the intensity as he has Tawei against the ropes and unleashes, like, what we talked about, these really stiff chops on him. He then shoots him into the ropes and hits a beautiful spinning heel kick that sends Tawei to the floor. Tawei is able to reverse his fortunes by whipping Kawada into the guardrails, and he gets back into the ring. As Kawada tries to get back into the ring himself, Tawei knocks him off the apron with a dropkick and then follows up with a tope suicida. And this goes towards this idea, like, you know, Tawei is gangly looking. He has a strange gait. But my God, this man is amazingly athletic and agile for, you know, the way he looks.
Yeah, it's the strangest thing. He pulls these things out of his hat occasionally, and yeah, they don't look super smooth. It's not like Kobashi hitting a beautiful plancha or anything like that, or Misawa. He somehow manages to get himself through the ropes. And I tell you what, I would not want that guy landing on top of me, especially if he is gangly. You never know where that elbow is going to hit.
He's a pretty tall man. You know, like, especially for a Japanese wrestler, like, you know, usually you don't get people that tall in Japan, but, you know, he's kind of an exception to the rule. But,
the less smooth that he is, the more likely he's going to crack you with an elbow or a knee, you know, whether it's on purpose or not.
I would imagine it's not on purpose from Tawei. But both men get back in the ring, and Tawei throws Kawada throat first onto the top rope. So he's also amping up the intensity of the match. Tawei puts Kawada into a very odd-looking chin lock that elicits some light laughter from the fans on this handheld version. I don't know if you noticed that, Brian.
I have to say I didn't, but it doesn't surprise me. Sometimes Tawei's holds or his strikes didn't inspire as much fear as perhaps you might think, but he gets away with it.
Well, he then follows up and applies a rather weak-looking sleeper hold with so much air in it that you could fly an Anatov AN-225 airplane through it. Like,
I mean, a John Cena special.
Yes, it's really, like, it's really light. And then again, the fans are kind of like chuckling at this. I felt it sounded, that's what it sounded like. From here, they get into a kicking exchange. But, you know, obviously, you know, Kawada's going to get the better of that. And then he gets the better of Tawei with a beautiful backdrop driver, not a head-dropping version, thank God. That's something we talked about in the last episode with Davey Portman, with Kawada, Kenta Kobashi and Steve Williams in that match. Kawada starts in on the kick straight to Tawei's forehead, the infamous signature Kawada kicks, and then walls him with a stiff kick to the back. And this was loud, Brian. On this handheld version, this is loud.
Yeah, I mean, Kawada, you know, I'm sure he's got the kick pads and everything on like that, but this was like a trademark Kawada. You would just see him wind up with what we would now call soccer kicks, you know, the old pride soccer kicks. He just doesn't seem to have any scruples about kicking you as hard in the back or in the legs as he wants to, which is kind of the appeal of Kawada, because you really do feel like he's winding up and giving everything into those strikes.
Well, I mean, that's what's true for all of them, though, isn't it? You know, they just would lay it in. That's the style of all Japan. And this is the same can be said of Misawa with his striking, and Kobashi's, you know, lariats and chops, and Tawei's like kicks to the face.
That's true.
Well,
but there is something even more visceral about just watching Kawada just wind up the leg, go all the way back and just kick somebody. Like, if you want to be kicked somewhere, you know, you don't want to be kicked as hard as possible in the back. I'm sure he's, you know, doing it in some kind of safe working way, but none of those people you mentioned, you know, kicks people like Kawada does.
Well, I mean, like, you know, I don't know. Would you say who kicks really more stiffly? Is it Kawada or Shinya Hashimoto?
Hashimoto likes to kick higher up towards the chest, and into the ribs more. Kawada's a lot. He kicks in the legs and he kicks in the back a lot if he's got his opponent down. So I wouldn't like to take either of them. I probably, if you put a gun to my head, I'd take Kawada's over Hashimoto's. I'd take it first. I should say Hashimoto. He's, I don't know, just as likely to kick you in the chin, I think.
I think with Hashimoto, I think he actually enjoys kicking people really hard. Yes. Whereas I think Kawada just does it.
It's a bigger part of Hashimoto's offense to do that.
I do remember reading. Do you remember when Rico Constantino in the 2000s went to All Japan for wrestling, and then after his tour with All Japan, he would just complain that I think he was referring to Kawada, that they were trying to shoot on him and they're trying to kill him. And it's just like, dude, that's just how they wrestle. And then how he was like, but he protected himself because he's an actual shooter. And I, at that point, I just lost it and started laughing at this, you know, this interview I'm reading with him about his time in All Japan. It's really funny. But like, I think if you're not used to it, if you're not trained in working a stiff style, like, you know, going to Japan, especially working any of those guys, especially Kawada or Stan Hansen, would not be pleasant experience for you. You would probably be quite shocked about, my God, this is not professional wrestling. This is a real fight.
Yeah, there's a similar story that the Rock and Roll Express tell about going to Japan. I wonder, was it 86-ish? And actually wrestling Kawada and Samson Fuyuki. And I think the first match they had, it may not have been televised, but anyway, the first match that they had, Kawada and Fuyuki were maybe not quite shooting on them, but you know, these were Americans coming in, and maybe they're trying to make themselves look better than us, and we don't want that to happen. And so there was almost a brawl backstage after their first match. And you know, as Ricky Morton was saying, you know, Robert Gibson is a decent sized guy, especially for people in Japan, perhaps. And you know, you don't want to see him too fired up. You don't want to see Hoot fired up, he says. So that's kind of a similar story. And in fact, I just heard Jim Cornette recently talk about the Fantastics, or the new Fantastics, being on an All Japan tour and coming back and stiffing people. I think it was Tracy Smothers, actually, stiffing people whenever they came back to Smoky Mountain.
Oh, really? Okay. Like, I do know Tracy Smothers worked Japan. I didn't know he worked in All Japan at the time. I do know like the original Fantastics, you know, Bobby Fulton and Tommy Rogers, they did really well in All Japan. Like, so they had no problem working a stiff style. But I mean, they started off in like World Class and like with, you know, Bill Watson, Mid South. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're used to like, you know, the stiff style, because like a lot of the UWF guys, you know, from Bill Watts, like they had no problem working, you know, All Japan. Gordy, Hanson, DiBiase. Like, I would imagine, like, if he didn't go to the WWF, like, you know, Jim Duggan would have probably gone to All Japan. Mm-hmm. He probably would have done very well as well. But getting back to this match, Kawada then follows up with a senton drop, and this leads into a figure four head scissors on Taue. Kawada is then put into a single leg crab, and he you know, creatively escapes the single leg crab from Taue by kicking Taue in the face, like, backwards with his free leg. I don't know if you caught this, Brian, but I was like, you know, Kawada is actually also very limber for a man of his size.
Yeah, as all these guys were. Actually, I could tell you a story about something that happened locally. I think it was the 2007 European navigation for NOAA when Misawa came over and did that drink. They probably did a date in Germany as well, I think. And they were going to, just, I think it was the day of the show, and they were going to a local wrestling training school in Manchester, the Future Shock Academy, and they were just going to apparently show some of the wrestlers, you know, some, just go over some little moves. Maybe they would do something in the ring, maybe they would just do some stretching, what have you. But Misawa got there, and he looked at the guys who were there, and he said, "These guys aren't flexible enough," and refused to coach them.
sounds very Misawa like yes. From here, Kawada and Taue take turns sending one another over the top rope. Kawada does so with a very risky looking backdrop. He's, you know, he just elevates, mm-hmm. he just shoots Taue into the air, you know, sending him to the floor. He follows Taue out to the floor to give him a power bomb. But, you know, Taue says, "Fuck that shit," and hits Kawada with his Nodoa Otoshi chokeslam on the floor instead. And the crowd just, you know, they're really getting into this match throughout the, you know, the course of it. But at this point, like the kind of excitement from the crowd and the energy is like just getting up, because, you know, Nodoa Otoshi is like one of Taue's signature moves. It's, mm-hmm. it's one of his killer moves. And so to get, you know, for him to hit it on Kawada on the floor, it's like it really pops the crowd at this point.
Yeah, it's one of those moves with Taue that people know to react to as soon as he grabs it. And, you know, he would do variations later on where he'd have his opponent on the apron and threaten to drop them onto the floor at ringside. So, yeah, doing that move, that would definitely get the crowd up. It certainly did here. And, yeah, on the floor as well. That, I mean, that's a potential match ender, especially in something like the Carnival, where you might just get a count out.
Yeah, I think, you know, things like that in the 80s, it might have happened. But, you know, at this point in time, like, you know, Baba doesn't want to have any, like, you know, like fuck finishes. He doesn't want countouts or DQs. So you kind of know at this point, like, he's trained the audience to know, like, oh, it's going to finish in the ring. But definitely, like, it you know, like, you think Kawada's definitely in danger.
Yeah, there's definitely peril there. I know what you're saying, and there were so few fuck finishes, as you called them, in 90s All Japan, but I think that's such a big move in Taue's arsenal that I do think still the possibility is still there.
Definitely. Taue, you know, continues his offense. He shows off his actually rather impressive strength by holding Kawada in the air for several seconds before slamming him down with like kind of a standing version of the Falcon's Arrow. And then he grabs Taue. Taue grabs Kawada by his wrist. He gets wrist control. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is a phrase we would use until like Kazuchika Okada, but, you know, Taue grabs wrist control of Kawada and then starts hitting with a couple of short range clotheslines, very, very similar to the Rainmaker. So maybe, you know, Kazuchika Okada watched this match and was like, I've got the idea for my finisher, you know, many, 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 many years later. He hits two short range clotheslines and he gets a pair of two counts on each of them. Kawada avoids a powerbomb by backdropping Taue, and mm-hmm. then he follows up with some kicks and a brainbuster, one of his signature moves, but only gets a two count on Taue. And things are just ramping up. We're now getting into like kind of like these two count sequences, Brian.
Yeah, you know, from the start, they sort of built it up with like a subtle, believable kind of back and forth. And, you know, once we start getting into the TV version that we mentioned, I guess like 14 minutes in or something, this is when they begin to start to bust out the big moves. And, you know, both guys are going for power bombs and trying to accomplish that. So, yeah, this is where the big moves come. This is where, you know, the near falls are going to come.
From here, Kawada hits a DDT on Tawei to the floor, and but quickly he gets Tawei back into the ring. He doesn't want to win this by countout. He wants to try to decisively beat him. And I think that's kind of one of the stories of this match, is that these two want to decisively try to get a win over the other and, of course, advance in the Champions Carnival. But I think, you know, like, they're having their macro story as a carnival, and their micro story is like their own rivalry.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the juxtaposition between this match and their previous matches, this match, when you think about, especially in hindsight, after you've watched it, you realize that this match was so much more about competition as opposed to violence or hatred between them. And that kind of leads on to the angle at the end. Yeah, that's the big difference between what's happening here.
They then start a stiff chop and slap exchange with one another. From here, Kawada blocks a Tawei face crusher. Tawei blocks a Kawada spitting kick. Tawei eats a kick but blocks a second one and hits Kawada with a great-looking folding power bomb. One thing I noticed about this sequence here, Brian, is that, you know, like, they're blocking each other's, like, kind of, like, you know, signature moves, and it goes towards the story that these guys know each other so well after, you know, being on opposite ends of, like, you know, the Super Generation Army Saruta Gun feud and in their own singles matches, that you know, they can kind of anticipate one another's moves.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you can also see by the kind of moves that they are going for. I mentioned the power bombs earlier. Both guys are trying that. Both guys are trying different versions of the sleeper hold. So they're, it's almost as if they have more in common than they previously realized. And the story of the match, again, especially with hindsight, is to kind of show that these guys could be an unstoppable force if they ever got together.
Tawei then goes, like you said, for a sleeper on Kawada, which elicits Kawada chants from the fans. They're really getting behind Kawada now because they feel like he's kind of like looking like he's gonna lose this match to Tawei. From here, it's now a war of strikes between these two, with both men countering some of their signature strikes. And I said, this goes to the point again, like, they know each other so well. Kawada hits one of his signature power bombs, but Tawei gets out a very close two count. Kawada then applies his own sleeper on Tawei, and the fans are going nuts at this point, Brian. They're well into it. They just know, oh my God, we're hitting the crescendo of this match. And it's like, yes, yeah, they're getting, you know, like, they're really, really, you know, anticipating something's exciting going to happen throughout the course of the match from this point on.
Yeah, and maybe you can tell me a bit more about what the actual commentary says on the Japanese TV version, because I wonder how much that sort of ramps it up as well. I mean, you can tell by the manner in which things are being spoken across there, but is there anything in the actual language of what they're saying that really builds this up?
No, not that I could notice. Like, I to be honest, like, my Japanese listening skills are okay, but I tend to think of most commentary as just background, especially Japanese commentary. It's just like, it's just more background noise for me. But, like, I catch a word here and there. I think they're just getting into the story of it. I think Baba, one thing about having Baba on commentary, it's very similar to like when Vince McMahon was the play-by-play guy on WWF television, is that he knows all the storylines. So he could talk about what's happening in each match very clearly, because he's the one who laid it out. So Baba, when having him on commentary, like, he's more of a color commentator. He's not the play-by-play guy. But the thing with Baba is that he can embellish a lot of what is happening in the ring, because obviously he booked it. He knows what's going to happen afterwards. He knows what's going to happen 2 weeks from now. He knows what's going to happen 2 months from now. So, you know, like, the announcers will, the play-by-play guy will ask Baba, like, oh, what do you think about this? What's happening right now? And Baba will give his opinion. But what he's actually doing is telling the fans, this is the story I want you to know about. So that's really the benefit of having Baba on commentary. And also, like, it's so soothing to hear Giant Baba's voice. I love hearing his very, you know, deep, you
sort
know,
of
bass
warbled
voice. He's like one of the adults from, like, the Peanuts cartoons, the Charlie Brown cartoons, for sure. But it's soothing. I rather enjoy hearing his voice. So if it's the first time you ever hear his voice, it can be a little jarring, but you get used to it very quickly.
Yeah, once you know it's Baba, then it's like, okay, it makes a bit more sense now.
And then you get to see what Baba looks like. It's like, oh, yeah, it fits perfectly with his voice. But from here, Kawada goes on the offensive with his kicks, but Tawai blocks one of the kicks and goes for a clothesline, but Kawada catches the arm and starts spinning Tawai to get him to the ground. But, you know, it's amazing. Tawai uses the momentum of, like, you know, Kawada taking to the ground to land in an awkward-looking but very effective kick to Kawada's back. Like, it's pretty stiff as well.
Yeah, you've actually made a note of that where I didn't. I'm not working off too many notes here, but yeah, I mean, Tawai could have his moments as well. So that's no surprise that that's happened. And again, that's sort of building up to the fact that you know, Tawai can really go. He can get really stiff and strong with his strikes when he wants to. Maybe there's more to this sort of partnership across the ring, their chemistry than previously met the eye.
Kawada blocks a choke slam and turns it into a Fujiwara armbar. Tawai kicks out of a stiff Kawada lariat, and the crowd just comes alive with dueling Kawada and Tawai chants. So, like, the crowd are now just, like, into both these guys. They just want to see someone win. I think they'd be okay with either or. Kawada kicks out of the Nodoa Otoshi, and again, the crowd just comes unglued at the two count. So again, this move is, like, you know, it's protected. It's one of, you know, Tawai's signature moves. And, you know, when you have, like, someone kick out of a move, whether it's, you know, and it's usually going to be, like, either Kawada Misawa or Kobashi, not one of, like, you know, not Kikuchi, not Ogawa, not who one of the younger undercard guys, but it's still a special thing to see when, like, when the finishing maneuvers gets kicked out of.
Yes. It doesn't feel like this is a part of the match where we're going to do our kickouts now, or we're going to do our false finishes now. That speaks to the whole of this match, but it also speaks to what All Japan was trying to create. You know, was that sort of sense of competition, a little bit of sports as well. And these were just the happenings. Like, this was not two guys who were going out there trying to have a great match. These were two guys going out there to try and convince people to a certain extent, to try and win to a certain extent. And the quality of the match is, like, a consequence of their greatness.
Well, also, we got to keep in mind this is a Champions Carnival match. So, yeah. You know, like, it's not a 60-minute time limit. It's a 30-minute time limit. So they have less time to win the match. And, you know, people are thinking, less time? What? It's like, well, you got to keep in mind, like, a lot of times, like, you know, All Japan main events are, like, you know, over 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes they're going to hit, like, the 40-minute range, especially title matches. So to have a singles match between two of the you know, like, top-tier wrestlers in the company, like, okay, they have less time to finish each other. So one of the stories that I think we can extrapolate, you know, from, you know, watching this match is that they kind of want to finish each other as soon as possible. They don't want to have an extended, you know, sequence of, like, trying to hit each other with as many bombs as possible. They just want to kind of, like, you know, wear their each other down, and to the point where, like, I want to get this win. I want to get the points to move on in the carnival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see that at a certain point in the match where the bombs start coming out, and then the counters start occurring, and the sort of nip and tuck of the thing and just trying to get a small advantage that doesn't play it into it anymore. They're going for the big ones.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, this is, like, the point where, you know, we're getting all these two counts and near falls, and the fans are just eating it up. Both men are just throwing whatever they can at each other to try to win the match. Tawai hits an impressive, for him, missile dropkick from the top row for a two count on Kawada here. Kawada gets on the stretch plum, and the crowd is going crazy, especially, you know, again, this is, like, you know, a signature submission move from Kawada, but, you know, Tawai is able to reach the ropes, and the match is still continuing. The crowd is like, oh my God, we're still getting this match. This awesome match is still going on. Mm-hmm. You know, Kawada hits a Tenryu, like, top rope elbow for a two count. And this is, again, like, this is, you know, kind of like, you know, the influence of Tenryu on Kawada. It's like, this is the exact same kind of elbow, you know, top rope elbow that Tenryu does. Like, he just climbs the top rope, and instead of, like, he doesn't do it Macho Man style. He just kind of, like, you know, he's facing towards the outside of the ring, and then he drops backwards to do the elbow. And this is the same thing that Kawada does. This is a move from, you know, from the rival of Jumbo Tsuruta, who, you know, so Kawada is facing the last kind of apprentice of Jumbo. So it's kind of appropriate that he's using these Tenryu moves on him.
Yeah, totally. I just want to go back and just make further mention of Towie's missile dropkick. It is just brilliant. It is a jump off the seat moment to see that guy go up there and hit this huge dropkick and take a funny landing. So, like if you're looking for big moves throughout the match, that's the one that gets you off your seat the most.
Oh, definitely. Like, you know, anytime Towie goes to the top rope, you think, oh my God, don't do it. You're just going to fall off because you're so awkward yeah. looking. But to his credit, he it doesn't really, you know, he's able to hit a lot of these, you yeah. know, rare.
He always finds a way. It may look awkward. It may look strained, but he always finds a way and always looks like it has a pretty decent impact. This one sure did.
So, you know, Brian, at this point, we got to talk about someone not inside the ring, but someone outside the ring. And that is one Masanobu Fuchi. Mm-hmm. And in the handheld version, like it's not clear exactly what he's doing, but if you watch the clip version, it's very clear what he's doing at this point. So you'll see Masa Fuchi looking at the ring and then looking at the timekeeper. And what he's doing is that he's anticipating the bell being counted, because every time Towie goes for, you know, a pinfall on Kawada, he's counting along with the ref. One, two, and then he's going to look at the timekeeper to, like, he wants to hear that bell ring. He wants to see the timekeeper hit the bell to signal the end of the match for Towie. And every time it doesn't happen, he's like, he has his exasperated look of frustration. Oh my God, Towie can't beat Kawada. And it's just, I just think it's amazing. Like, he is such a brilliant man. And we don't talk about Masa Fuchi enough, but this guy is so brilliant. He understands, like, he's not in the match itself, but he's part of the match. He's part of getting the fans emotionally invested in the match by what he's doing on the outside without detracting from the match. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's a very big part of the match and the angle when it comes down to this. And yeah, if you haven't yet talked about Fuchi too much in this series, then hopefully someone will do that down the line, because Fuchi is an incredible wrestler. Even in this, he appears in sort of this veteran status even more so than, say, Jumbo or whomever at this early 90s point. This man is a sadist inside the ring. Anytime you see him with Kikuchi, you know, he's very happy to, you know, bend Kikuchi over backwards over the ropes, or, you know, stand on his neck and things like that. Just cruel things that this man would perpetrate. Fuchi's brilliant to watch.
Oh, yeah. And again, like, he's not a manager, but he's kind of like a cheerleader. Mm-hmm. He's like,
he's a seconding
Towie. Yeah. He's a second. And it's quite like I said, it's just like, I just love watching this man in any capacity he's involved in pro wrestling, mm-hmm. especially at this point in time. Towie escapes numerous stretched plum attempts from Kawada as the timekeeper starts announcing that the time limit is quickly approaching. You can sense the tension in the crowd is just ratcheting up here, Brian. And like, they're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Like, I think there's as much drama as if you think you're going to be getting a time limit draw as you are if, like, one of the guys is going to win.
Yeah, it's about knowing what the result is going to be. And I guess in some ways there's some hope that you know, there may be a conclusion, like a pinfall or a submission or something like that, and whether it can happen in those final sort of 15 seconds, 20 seconds, especially if you're partisan and you want one of the wrestlers to win more than the other. But it's when a match is this good, just finding out the conclusion to what's going to happen is kind of almost, it's almost like a sporting event. You know, you just want to know what's going to happen. Is it going to be a draw? How many points will these people get on the board? Is it possible that a miracle could happen in the last 5 seconds?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but, you know, a miracle actually doesn't happen because from this point in my notes.
But that's okay.
It's okay. Kawada goes for his final powerbomb, and it's pretty much at the 1 minute mark, and that's announced by the timekeeper. And as soon as, like, you know, Tawei's, you know, shoulders hit the ground, like, Kawada goes for a pin. Kyue Wada goes for the count. He hits one. And then the timekeeper bell announces, and then this match is over. It has reached the 30-minute time limit, and it's a draw for both these guys. The post-match sequence sees, like, both guys getting up. They're being attended to by their seconds, Towie by Fuchi, Kawada by Kikuchi. And, you know, like, they draw, you know, Kyue Wada draws both of them into the center of the ring. He raises both their hands up in the air. And from this point, Kawada, he's the one. He extends his hand to Towie for a handshake, and Towie accepts, and the fans are gasping. They're like, oh, what's happening here?
Yeah.
What? I've never seen this. These guys hate each other. They've had bloodbaths with one another. So this is a monumentous, you know, occurrence. Like, this is a very big moment for the All Japan fans. And in retrospect, obviously, this is the start of the Holy Demon Army. And let's talk about the post-match, what your impressions of it, and then let's talk about the kind of the legacy of the Holy Demon Army.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really interesting. When Kawada is able to get to his feet after the match, you immediately can see that there's sort of something on his mind, and you can take that to be a part of the story, or maybe he for real is thinking he knows what's going to happen next. But there's like something on it. There's something on his mind. He's not happy about the draw, but he's also not that hugely disappointed. There's something else going on in there, and he's kind of thinking about it. And eventually, whenever the two guys come together to have the decision explained by the referee, then Kawada's kind of looking at Taui, and he's almost looking to get that eye contact from Taui. And when he eventually does, there's it's certainly not like a Mega Powers handshake, you know, Hogan and Savage doing the dramatic handshake. It's almost like a clasping of the hand kind of handshake, just a small amount of respect, just to see where that will lead. Kawada almost leans in to give him a pat on the back, but then does not do that. There's all these sort of subtle little things going on that you can take different things from, but you can just see where Kawada has had this great match with this guy, has been since he's been battling him for so many years, but now he realizes that this guy is sort of the real deal. Kawada has had many victories in tag matches and singles matches over Taui, but he sees something at this point, whether it's the fact that Kawada, along with Mizawa, recently lost the tag team titles, I think at the end of the previous year. Maybe he sees that the grass could be greener on the other side. Maybe he sees that he wants to be aligned with Taue more so than he does want to be sort of second or third in Mizawa's group. But whatever it is, there's something on his mind. If you go back and watch it, you'll see it pretty clearly. And they do this sort of halfway handshake just to see what the other's thinking about it. Like I say, Kawada almost gives him a pat on the back, but thinks better of it. And there's questions after this great match that, I guess, if you want to call it a cliffhanger, you could.
Well, I mean, like, you know, one thing like I noticed, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but like on Kikuchi's face, he's like thinking, what happened there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You shook his hand. He's still our enemy. He's still on the other side. And in terms of like, you know, like we're talking about, you know, Brian, like there's, you know, Jumbo's winding down. He's phasing out. Misawa's now the ace of the company. So like Kawada, like both in kayfabe terms and in real life, you know, realizes, oh my God, there's an opportunity for me to, you know, raise myself in the ranks of this company where I'm not Misawa's number two, but I could be like the, you know, the 1B to his 1A. You're right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, so, but to do that, I have to break away from Misawa. And, you know, like one thing that is very important in All Japan is to have a tag team. You have to be part of a tag team as well as be a great singles wrestler. Like all the great, you know, wrestlers of All Japan Pro Wrestling were part of great tag teams as well as being great singles wrestlers. Misawa with Kawada, Kobashi, Akiyama and Ogawa throughout his tenure in All Japan Pro Wrestling. Kobashi with Misawa, with Kikuchi, Misawa, and Akiyama. And then, you know, Kawada with both Misawa and with Taue. So like at this point, he's like, okay, he sees I have to be on the opposite side of Misawa. And this guy, you know, has gone to war with me and Kobashi Misawa. He's the guy I need to be my ally in this. And, you know, and they form the Holy Demon Army. And then we're not going to get too deep into the Holy Demon Army, but Brian, what are your thoughts about this legendary tag team? I think it's the greatest tag team in All Japan history. I think it's definitely like in the top five of the greatest tag teams of all of professional wrestling.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I can't imagine any other tag teams having sort of more five-star matches across any period. I hate to bring up star ratings, but it's the easiest way for us to qualify these things. Like there was matches, the main one that people think of when they think of the Holy Demon Army is seemingly dozens of matches against Misawa and Kobashi. It's not that many, of course, but there's Tag League Finals. The Tag League Final of that year, in fact, 93, is Misawa and Kobashi beating Kawada and Tawai for that's a title change as well. But there's matches every year. There's the famous match 6-9-95, as people like to call it, 9th of June 1995. One of the greatest matches of all time, singles or tag. That's another title change. An incredible match that everybody has to see. And once the Misawa and Kobashi, once they sort of split and Misawa begins to team with Akiyama, the feud just sort of continues. Again, great match. I think they've at least two or three great matches in 1996 alone. So, and including a tag league final, which is another classic. So yeah, just incredible matches all the way through with all different kinds of opponents. But people will always look to the tag matches with either Misawa and Kobashi or Misawa and Akiyama.
Well, one thing I like about, you know, the Holy Demon Army is that, you know, they're very different. Kawada and Tawai, like mm-hmm. the way they wrestle. But they complement each other through those differences really well. Like stylistically, they do things. They do a lot of like actual really impressive double teaming moves against their opponents. But they're also very unique. Like Kawada's more kind of, you know, like a striker, kind of does a more kind of MMA kind of style. Like, you know, for a guy from All Japan of the 90s, mm-hmm. he's not like Shinya Hashimoto or anything like that. But he does a lot of the kicks that are based around martial arts and things like that. Whereas Taui is very, very much a pro wrestler.
There was actually one thing I wanted to bring up, and forgive me for going backwards a little bit, but in terms of this sort of storyline, we have this match, of course, on the 12th of April we've just talked about, where Kawada and Tawai do shake hands. And it's interesting, a couple of weeks later on TV, Kawada actually teams. He still teams with Kobashi and Kikuchi. Kawada and Tawai are rarely in there together against each other. When they are, you can see that they're both thinking it over as to, like, I guess what they should do, but, you know, how much they want to really battle this other person that they've got so much respect for, and perhaps, someone who they recognize should be working together as a team. So there is that one match on TV that they have where Kawada is still with Super Generation Army. And then it's like another couple of weeks after that, Kawada really has gone to the other side, so to speak. He has a singles match with Kikuchi that he wins. And then he debuts the Holy Demon Army team with Tawai in the middle of May.
I think that's at Korakuen, and I think their first match is against Kobashi and Kikuchi. And that's an amazing match.
Yes.
It's like, I recommend fans watch like the six man that you're talking about following this match, and then watch, you know, the May match with Kawada and Tawai teaming really for the first time ever in Korakuen Hall against the team of Kobashi. You can tell, like, Kobashi especially is pissed. He's mad that Kawada has left Super Generation Army and is teaming with Tawai at this point. It's fantastic. It's really a prelude to like the battles that Kawada and Tawai will have with, you know, Kobashi and a multitude of different partners that he'll have, whether it's Misawa or whether it's Johnny Ace or later on in the late 90s with Jun Akiyama. Is just the dynamic with Kobashi against Kawada and Tawai, but Kawada especially is a lot more, not more interesting, but it's very different from the dynamic between Misawa and Kawada.
Just, sorry, repeat that for me again. I didn't quite catch you.
Oh, sorry. Like, I always think that it's really interesting, the dynamic between Kobashi and Kawada mm-hmm. is different, but it's no less interesting than the dynamic between Kawada and Misawa as opponents.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, Kawada and Misawa sort of have that sort of backstory about being in the same like high school and things like that that Kobashi and Kawada don't have. But yeah, I think equally in the ring, Kawada and Kobashi have almost as good, if not just as good, chemistry. Is it, I hope I'm not wrong here, is it Kawada's first defense of the Triple Crown where he wrestles Kobashi to a draw? And I think it's a 60-minute draw, which is a classic match. I hope I've got that right. But, you know, so they definitely had chemistry. They could have long matches where they work together really well. And yeah, the chemistry is excellent. Mizawa and Kawada to me is on another plane, I guess, to some degree, just because of the backstory and everything. And also that's part of my fandom, my early fandom of enjoying All Japan. I know some people will look at the matches between Mizawa and Kobashi and say that they are the peak of 90s All Japan, but I have to say that Mizawa and Kawada is where it's at for me.
Oh, I think, you know, the story of All Japan Pro Wrestling of this era, you know, there's three things that you have to look at. It's like the rivalry between Misawa and Jumbo Tsuruta, the kind of like the rise of Kenta Kobashi in the mid to late 90s, and the rivalry really of like from this point from 93 on to even in Pro Wrestling Noah, like the rivalry between Misawa and Kawada. And, you know, you could argue which one is the most important. I would agree with you. I think the rivalry between Misawa and Kawada is the most important thing. And, you know, like from this match, the formation of the Holy Demon Army is a very, very integral part of that rivalry, as much as any of their singles matches against each other, whether it's in the Champions Carnival or for the Triple Crown title. So, yeah, I mean, that's it. That's the match. And Brian, you know, like, thank you so much for joining me and taking the time out of your schedule to talk about this match, talk about both these guys and about this great tag team.
It is my pleasure to watch All Japan, talk about All Japan, anything All Japan. I love this period. It's my favorite period of any pro wrestling, even beyond, you know, my sort of early WWF nostalgia from when I was a child. This is the great wrestling that I can still watch, that I'm still discovering, actually, because new footage seems to appear kind of all the time. And you get to see these things that previously you hadn't seen before, or you get to see full versions. It's only a couple of years ago that we got the full version of, you know, Furnace and Crawford against Kikuchi and Kobashi from 92. So we're always sort of discovering these little things, and it's great in the fandom when you get to do that.
You know, with all these streaming services out there, Brian, like, I really think, you know, Nippon TV could make a lot of money. I feel.
They could make a lot of money off me, that's for sure.
If they just had a streaming service covering, yeah, like say 1985 to 2000, oof, of All Japan Pro Wrestling, like, and just started releasing things every month, like maybe chronological order, that would be cool. I know at least like 100 people who would sign up for this for like, if it was like $10-$15, I would totally sign up for it.
Yeah, can you imagine if this stuff was you know, scanned in 1080p or something like that? You know, whenever I was first starting collecting, getting tapes from All Japan from tape traders, you know, the quality sometimes left a lot to be desired. I should have mentioned this at the start. Here's a great piece of trivia. What do you think? Just have a wild guess about what the first All Japan match I ever saw was. The tape I would have got would have been in around 93. You'll have to go a couple of years before that. Just take a wild guess. You couldn't possibly get it.
Okay. So I'm going to think just, you know, like it's an.
I'll give you the year. It was 89. The first match from All Japan I ever saw was from 1989.
Was it like Bruiser Brody versus Abdul the Butcher or something?
Dan Spivey against Sting. So from 1989.
I've seen that match too.
Yeah, it's okay. It's pretty good for what it is. So a very strange debut to All Japan in some regard, because, you know, two American guys and, you know, Sting making one of very, very few appearances for All Japan as opposed to New Japan. But at least that didn't put me off at the start, and I got completely into All Japan and have been into it for all this time since that the first time I got a tape. I should give a shout out to my good friend Neil Topping, who actually lent me the tape at the time. He was the first to get into the tape traders and to get their lists. So he actually got a tape first and lent me Japanese Action 4 and 5. And that sent me on my merry way.
That's amazing, the name of that compilation, Japanese Action 4 and 5. Incredible. Brian, let's get some plugs in. Tell people where they can find more of your work.
Well, probably the best way to connect with me is on Twitter at hardcopy.ie. That's hardcopy, D-O-T-I-E. There's also my website, which is hardcopy.ie, funnily enough. And there's I've got a few little things up there. Business has kind of got in the way. Work has kind of got in the way recently, but I've done some wrestling podcasts up there. The podcast is called Riffing on Wrestling. I'm a huge fan of classic rock, so there's a podcast that I run called Rock Rules. You can search for any of those things. I also also do a podcast on Manchester United football team with Killian Dane of WWE fame. So that's one that's, it's been a little bit on the back burner just recently just because of work and everything. But these are three things that I'm kind of into and doing at the minute. I'm actually looking for sort of the next level to take these two, whether it to be to find a new home for these podcasts or to even develop a Patreon or something like that. So we'll see how that goes in the near future. But if you follow me on Twitter at hardcopy.ie, you'll get all the updates.
Well, I'm definitely going to be following your website a lot more closely these days. I was perusing through it and I thought, oh, there's some really great stuff. It was great talking with you, and I hope to have you back on a future episode of the Long and Winding Royal Road down the line. As you know, I get, there's a lot of people who want to talk about All Japan, but like, you know, like I feel at some point this show can go on forever. At some point, I'm going to have like repeat guests, and I definitely would like you to be a repeat guest on this, Brian.
It would be my pleasure. I would love to talk about All Japan anytime.
All right. And thank you to all the fans, for the listeners, for listening, tuning in and showing a lot of support for the show, getting a lot of great feedback to the episodes. And, you know, for those of you, like, you know, we're going to be releasing this. This is being released in December, so it's almost Christmas season. So those of you who want to support the show, get the Post ProRes t-shirt at store.prowrestling.com. And on behalf of Brian, I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and I'll see everyone on the next episode. And until then, goodbye.